I remember driving to my first game in the Garden, and I was so energized, just like weaving through traffic. It's like I was playing a video game, and I was like so energy. When I got to the Garden, I'm like, man, wait a minute. I'm feeling like tired now.
Yeah.
Because it's just so much energy that you have to bring every night, emotional, mental, physical. And that challenge every night was nothing like it.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Club 30. I'm your host, Henrik Lundqvist. I'm sitting here with my friend, Jay Lydell. How was your week, Jay?
Week's good. It's a beautiful day in New York City. I'm excited to be back here in the studio with you, brother.
Yeah, it's always a beautiful day in New York City. Speaking of New York City, one of my favorite things in New York City, being people eating, going to the Garden and watch a Knicks game.
Same.
You know, it's a spectacle. It's a show. And you feel like you're part of the game when you sit there and watch. And the intensity, you see the crowd talking to the players. That interaction, you don't see in many sports.
Agree.
And I love that when you see the crowd, especially in New York. They get involved in the game, talking to the players. The players talk back.
Yeah, 100%. I think, you know, obviously lucky to sit, you know, so close when I go with you. And it's incredible. But the thing that sets apart MSG from all the other courtside seats around the league is that most of them are diehard fans, right? You got Spike Lee there. You got, I mean, and it's a revolving door of folks that live and breathe New York and live and breathe New York basketball. And it's awesome.
That was something that I realized pretty quickly, what a big basketball town New York City really is.
Yeah.
You know, and the cool thing is also that obviously being a Knick, it's a huge honor and exciting, but you also see other players come in and they want to play their best games here.
Yeah.
It means something to them.
Right. Everybody wants to be traded to the Knicks, right? Everybody wants to perform under the, you know, they don't call it the most famous arena in the world for nothing.
Yeah.
And now that phrase, I think, means New York Knicks basketball. You know, it's such an important cultural centerpiece of the city. The energy in there, you can feel it.
Yeah. And I can think back with so many great moments, you know, Kobe coming here, when LeBron comes, and all the big stars, they really try to play their best games here, which to me is, it's just, it makes it even more special to be there and watch the Knicks. And today, finally, we have our first Knicks player. It's a Knicks legend.
Yeah.
Allen Houston on the show.
We are long overdue, and we're starting off the Knicks representation on Club 30 with a bang. Allen is, he's obviously one of the best shooters to ever play. And also, he's been deeply involved in the Knicks organization since his retirement, so it's going to be a good one.
And he's the nicest person. I've gotten to know him a little bit over the years. When I played, I saw him around, but obviously now when I spend more time at the Garden, as a non-player, I definitely have more time to talk to him and interact with him. And he's such a great person. So I'm really excited the fact that he's joining us today. So,
yeah, I'm excited to meet him. Yeah, it's going to be great. It's funny, I grew up in Canada as a Bulls fan. We didn't have any basketball team back then. There was no Raptors. And the Knicks were hard to love as an outsider, as not a Knicks fan, because the style of play in the early 90s was pretty rough and tumble. You know, it was physical hoops. But when Houston arrived from Detroit, they started to play this more skilled game, I would say, or more visually appealing game. Like, he's just this amazing, silky, smooth shooter. And with him and Sprewell, really athletic guys, it made a non-Knicks fan really appreciate New York basketball. And I didn't know I was going to move to the city, you know, eventually. But I was, you know, so it made me really appreciate the game here. And then ultimately, that was part of the gateway of me becoming a Knicks fan.
Is that how you view Allen? A smooth shooter?
Yeah, silky.
Silky.
great. I mean, I think when he started, he was, you know, he's incredible at creating his own shot. But then his evolution, he became more physical and learned how to kind of mix his game up as he evolved as a player. And obviously that's why he's an all-star.
Well, let's see if he views himself as a silky shooter. We should bring him on.
We should
see where this takes us. He's a two-time NBA All-Star and one of the top scorers in Knicks franchise history. We are never going to have a guest on this show with a sweeter jump shot. Welcome to Club 30, number 20, Allen Houston.
It's an honor to be here, man. Yeah. I made it. I feel like I made
Long
it.
Long overdue.
I feel like I made it.
Yeah.
Well, thanks for being
Thank
here.
Thank you. Yeah.
Listen, you played 12 years in the NBA, 9 for the Knicks. and representing the Knicks for that long. What stood out to you? What was the best part about being a Knick? Was it playing at the Garden? Was it the fans, city? What was it?
All the above, man.
All the above.
You know, it's, you know, New York. When I came from Detroit, I think a lot of people, because of my laid-back demeanor, a lot of people were like, that's kind of an interesting choice. But I think for me, is you always want to challenge yourself to see what you can do. You know, like you work all this time to be, to put yourself in the best possible position, to put yourself in the, be on the grandest stage. And there was no, like, this is Madison Square Garden, it's New York. And at that time, you know, they had just lost in 94 in the finals, had that year in 95. So, I mean, obviously the money didn't hurt. but I think.
Because you came over in free agency.
Yeah, came in free agency.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I think just being on that stage every night. One thing you know about being in New York is you can't really, you can have an off shooting night, but you can't have an off night energy wise, right? You know, it's almost like, I remember driving to my first game in the Garden, and I was so energized, just like weaving through traffic. It's like I was playing a video game, and I was like so energy. When I got to the Garden, I'm like, man, wait a minute, I'm feeling like tired now, because it's just so much energy that you have to bring every night, emotional, mental, physical, and that challenge every night was nothing like it. And then the energy never stops. It's not just the lights, right? It's the people. They don't just come up to you like nonchalantly. It's like, ow. Like so many times people are like, ow, ow. I'm like looking like, do I know you? Like people, they say it like they know you. It's just, it's like an energy about being in here that there's just, you can't match it.
Yeah.
We talked about before you came on here, being a Knick is one thing, but also playing at the Garden as a visitor, it's a thing.
Yeah.
Like you see all the top players, they want to have a night in this arena.
Yeah.
Like, is that something players talk about? Or it's just
know
the way it is.
Yeah. It's history. You know, from the time you're a kid, like you see moments at the Garden, like you see history. My mother grew up two doors down from Muhammad Ali, and I remember seeing clips of Muhammad Ali and Sonny Liston. Like the history of the Garden is this. So when you play in the building, there's an awe about it, nostalgia about it already.
Right.
That speaks for itself. You don't have to say anything. It just is there. And you know, like I remember it coming from the Pistons playing in New York, and it seemed like the speakers was louder, the music was louder, just everything was like, it was just on 10.
Yeah.
And that's what you get up for. Mm-hmm. And the thing that you know is playing, you have to kind of like neutralize that, negate that very early when you're playing as the home team, because you don't want to let guys and let teams start to feel that energy working for them. You need to make it work against them if you can.
It's funny. Yeah, that's a great point. And I think there's a thing that's different about the energy at MSG. Like, no hate on the Lakers.
Yeah, it's different.
High energy. It's different. I think the basketball IQ in New York is extremely high. You know, and to your point earlier about people calling you like first name, because if you're in New York, you're probably pretty good at something. And if you're sitting next to the bench, you're probably pretty good at something. They view you as a peer rather than as a celebrity.
Yeah. Sometimes they might view you as an employee.
Well, they are paying for your salary.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But you're right. Like, I think you have to come with one thing that kind of hit me about being in New York is, usually your team is a reflection of the people who live. Like, you take on the personality and identity, and everybody in New York feels like they have to make it. They're here to make it, right? And they're here to scratch and claw, and it's the most competitive place in the world. So I need to see you compete like I'm competing every day.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that they love, like you said, the IQ. But they love just the competitiveness to go along with it.
Yeah, that's what makes the city.
Do the fans get more involved in other arenas, or is it similar across the league in terms of how much they speak to the players? Because that's something that I thought was so cool, you know, coming here, watching basketball, just how much the fans actually get involved and how much the players interact.
Yeah.
You know, you don't see that in a lot of sports.
Mm-hmm. It's funny, too, like, you feel connected to those first few rows too. Like, you know, in some arenas, it feels like there's a little bit of distance. Mm. But in the Garden, you're like right there. It's probably like an actor who's performing right up close to someone, yeah. and you feel that connection. You just sense it. There's a lot of stuff you don't consciously know, but it's there. So I think that interaction, New York fans are intense, but they're sophisticated. So, you know, some of the dumb stuff you might hear other fans say, they like, I don't need to say that. I'm just going to keep it. And then when I need to say something, I'll say it. And it's just it's a very sophisticated interaction, right, with players.
I love it. I think it's so funny when you hear the fans getting involved. And
yeah.
in my head, I'm like, who are you talking right. back to the players? I'm right. like, that's what I'm thinking. But at the same time, I'm fascinated by it.
Yeah.
And again, yeah. hockey, you kind of divide it with the glass. And for me, I had a mask on, so I didn't really see the crowd at all. But here you're eye to eye with the fans.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a big difference in hockey, right? Everybody's behind masks and there's the glass. You just don't have that intimacy.
I mean, I was at a game a couple weeks ago. They played the Nuggets, and Jokic, he tripped on the camera guy and fell into my lap. I'm like, of all guys, I get this massive human just falling in my lap. I was like, oh, I'm part of this game here. Yeah. You ready?
You're in it. You're in the mix.
but for you, what was your dad, your grandfather, great coaches. Was basketball always the thing? Or did you have other dreams growing up?
It's kind of all I knew growing up. You know, my grandfather, my maternal grandfather, was one of the all-time winningest basketball coaches in high school history in Kentucky. My father, my grandfather, and me are all in the Kentucky Athletic Hall of Fame, and that's very unique. It broke the color barrier in a lot of ways. Before integration, he was one of the all-time winningest coaches. He won 4 national championships in high school before, and pushed for integration, which was really kind of countercultural at the time. But he realized that, you know, his players and students needed to have a stage. Mm-hmm. And my father, same, broke the color barrier at Louisville for a first black scholarship basketball player, or at least one of the first 3. And then became the first black head coach in SEC history at the University of Tennessee. So I think growing up, it's kind of like I was around it, but my parents did a good job of keeping it kind of healthy, right? Mm. It was, you know, back then it was, they were both teachers, both educators, they were both community leaders. So my parents were always involved in lives, and the game was always like an expression of that. So by the time I realized I can play a little bit, you know, it was the culture and the habits were already kind of built in.
Yeah.
And I didn't think about playing, literally like dream and envision myself like really being an NBA player till I was probably a freshman in college.
Oh, really?
At the time. Yeah. So at the time I wanted to play for Louisville. My dad was an assistant at Louisville. He has so many great players that he recruited and coached, and I looked up to them. They were like my NBA.
Yeah.
So by the time I started getting the attention and going to the camps and being recruited, I already knew I was going to play for my dad. And it was then that I'm like, you know what? I'm going to go, you know, I just wanted to work hard and be good.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like that's what he really taught. He taught character, just work really hard. And we never really talked about like NBA, because I think he knew from coaching a lot of NBA players, I've seen a lot of talented players that fall. Mm. And I think his thing was like, what made them fall, I got to make sure you're like have a stable footing.
Yeah.
And it was like seeing how he treated his players, how he treated my mom, how he dealt with adversity, being in the South, being the first black coach, like he took a lot of heat. I just watched all this, and I think for me, that helped me keep everything in perspective. So when you get to a place like New York, you understand the big picture,
yeah.
right? You understand this is a game. People are going to be high and low. You know, you're going to face the heat, but you just got to treat the game the same way as if you're making $100 million or $1, right? You just got to treat it the same way. And that was really what they preached.
I mean, and that's challenging. You know, if you're a star college basketball player, you are not far away from signing the big ticket, playing the NBA. So how do you stay present? I think that's so important what you're talking about, that how can you stay present and be focused on here and now and not get ahead of yourself? Because that's where you lose guys, right? They're already arrived, but they haven't.
Yeah.
They still need to deliver at college level, right?
Yeah. But,
so to have that, so the influence of your dad obviously had a
yeah, that's huge... the character you talk about, right? Like having the ability to make good choices.
Well, it wasn't always the best choices, you know. Don't let me sit up here, you know. I think it's, and the challenge is you always want more. Like you're always looking at somebody else's check or somebody else's contract. You always want, you know, the fight is wanting what somebody else has instead of what's for you.
Right.
You know, and staying in that moment where I just take care of my job and do what I need to do. And that's why, like, when I made my two All-Star appearances, I didn't even average 20 points. But it was about playing on a team that had a winning culture and style. And the degree of difficulty, as you know, playing in New York, people understand, like, okay, you impact winning in a different way. Yeah, I mean, I'm a scorer, but I didn't have to try to score 25 points. I don't even know if I could have at the time, the way the scoring was.
Right.
You know what I mean? But it was about, like you're saying, staying just in that moment and just trying to impact winning the way you could.
Yeah.
And so you arrived in New York in 96, and you talked about the All-Star game, 99, Olympics.
Yeah.
You went to Sydney. You won the gold. How was that experience for you?
It was all, man. So my 96, 97, first playoff series in New York is incredible. And then you go to 98. Play the Heat, go to 99.
All right, let's stop right there, by the way, because I had that question later on, but
yeah,
game five, you yeah. know, the second to go,
yeah,
game
yeah.
on the line. Like, I want to know what goes through your head. I mean, if you're a basketball player, I'm sure it happens a lot where the game is on the line, you need to take a shot, but then you have moments that are just way bigger.
Yeah.
How do you approach that as a player?
To be honest, I would love to ask you that question of how that happens when you got to – The thing is coming so fast and you know you need to make that stop. But I think it's repetition, right? You repeat something so much and you put yourself in that moment so much that at that point it's about execution. You know, it's not about, you know, thinking about making or missing. You're thinking about, like at the free throw line, whether it's you need to make it and you're down one with 3 seconds to go or not, it's you're focusing on the execution. And so for us, we didn't have a timeout. We knew the play, obviously. It's really about I set my man up, had a great screen. Charlie Ward made a great delivery right where it needed to be at the right time. I saw Alonzo Mourning coming. I wasn't going to try to force it. So I really didn't have a choice. You know, the best shots are when you don't have time to think anyway, right?
Yeah.
You just play off instincts.
Exactly. You talk about execution. That's what you're thinking about. You don't think about the moment.
Yeah.
As soon as you start thinking about the moment, I mean, you're done.
Right. Yeah.
It's really, but to stay in that moment and strictly think about your execution.
Yeah.
Exactly how you want to hold your hands, or for me, like my stance, or...
Yeah.
Because then it makes you less nervous too.
Yeah.
All you're thinking about is exactly what I need to do technically.
Technically, right.
Yeah. And that helps the execution.
Hanky, did you have a moment like that that you look back on and think like, well, wow, if I had been in my head there, it would have gone a different direction?
I think penalty shot is a perfect example.
Gotcha.
Because then you have a lot of time to think.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When it's a regular play, you don't have time. But on a penalty shot, okay, you know now it's going to be a penalty shot. And it's about 30 seconds before the player is going to touch the puck because the ref is setting it all up. So now, okay, what are you thinking right now? Are you thinking about the moment, or are you thinking about what you need to do to stop this guy? Remember.
So are you thinking about their tendencies? Like, what are you – are you looking
– I'm strictly thinking about what I need to do.
Gotcha.
Timing, come out. Certain distance, when to start backing up. I remember like the outdoor game against Philly. It was a 3-2 game with 20 seconds to go, and it's a penalty shot.
Yeah.
It's 50,000 outdoor game. And it's like, okay, how do I stay in the moment? Strictly think about what I need to do. And the same thing to win the gold at World Championships. We played Canada. Last penalty shot.
Yeah.
If I stop this, we win World Championships. So how do I not go there with my thoughts? Like, we're going to celebrate. We're going to have the best time. Yeah. No, strictly just, okay, I need to come out a certain distance. I need to think how I hold my glove, and I need to time this perfectly. That's where I'm trying to constantly repeat until it's over.
I'm being interviewed, but I got to ask you, because I get asked this a lot about making shots, right? Do you think that is a quality that is people just kind of have a more of ability to focus like that, and some just can't in those moments? Or what do you think is something you just can keep working on?
I think everybody's different how they get there, like mentally in that zone. But for a goalie, I think it's such a huge part of your game to be in that moment, because we can never dictate the play. We can only react to what's going on. So you need to be, your focus needs to be in the right place. So I learned like around 15, 16, 17 years old that preparation was so important for me to get to into that state of mind, like the hours before game, what am I thinking about? And but then you have other guys. They need to be loose and relaxed, and that's how they find that. But it really came down to that focus and being in the moment. And you know, it's such a good feeling when you're in the moment, because you don't think about consequences or the moment, or what you think about it is execution.
Was there a time in your career, Alan, that your priority for preparation shifted more to the mental side of things?
It's a good question. Yeah, I mean, I was always a person who just you get lost in the work of it, right? Nobody ever had to tell me to work harder. I was always considered, you know, someone who really worked, because I just enjoyed at the early age, just loved to play. You know, loved to just go out and play. I do think that around 2000, around that time, the Olympics, you know, you get to a point in your career and life, you're just like, okay. You start to try to mature, you find your purpose, and look at something like, what am I really doing here? And I started to truly try to understand like how the inner part of your mind and the body, and even spiritually, like how does it all connect? And, you know, I wanted to just keep pushing myself in that way. So I did, you know, start really trying to get deeper and higher with myself and just push myself in that way. But I do, you know, go back to like what H was saying. It's like you got to enjoy that preparation part of it.
Yep.
You know what I mean? And challenge yourself to be. I remember like there were some moments where we need that shot to go into overtime to win it, and you're in that point where you're setting up the play, and I would find a friend in the crowd and just wink at him, just do something fun. You're like in that moment, just to lighten it. You know what I mean? And I would do stuff like that. You know, you have to kind of play games with yourself too. You know, and to keep it fun and think about the positive outcome of it.
Oh yeah, that's another thing. You need to see yourself succeed. That's the only way. I mean, if you look the other way, then 100% you're going to fail.
Absolutely. Hey, you know, you talked a little bit earlier about, you know, when you were voted as an all-star, you know, you had this complete game and you weren't necessarily, you know, scoring leader, but you joined the Dream Team in 2000. And that's like almost the antithesis of a team and role playing, because there's no role players on the Dream Team, especially for USA basketball. What was that like?
Well, I would say there still was a bit of that. You still had to find, like every team, especially when you're playing on a role team like that, you have to find your way. You know, you're not going to get the many shots. So you have to find, you have to be more efficient. The biggest part of that, man, was I would say go back before that in 1992 when I was a junior in college and I got to be one of eight players to play against the original Dream Team. That was like my first really, I mean, unforgettable USA basketball experience. You know, you're playing against, you know, Michael and Larry, like that team, the best team that will be ever be assembled, and they're training, right, to take, you know, USA basketball from college amateur to the pro level. And there were eight of us. It was, you know, Penny Hardaway, Chris Webber, Jamal Mashburn. I mean, Rodney Rogers, Bobby Hurley, rest in peace, Eric Montrose. Man, are you talking about like an incredible experience just hanging out with the guys, you know, after watching them play cards, you know, seeing, playing golf with them. And it was the same thing in the Olympics, like getting to know the guys, you know what I mean? All that time on the bus, you know, I remember one golf outing, Lonzo Mourning and I were playing behind Bill Gates. And like, had we known, then, like, how to play that card, I would have been so, I don't know what I'm looking back at myself, man, why didn't you just, like, you know.
Maybe you're lucky that you didn't.
Maybe, I don't know. But, but those are the type of things you never forget.
Yeah. So who did you have with you going to Sydney? I just want to hear the experience.
Lonzo Mourning, Jason Kidd, Ray Allen, Tim Hardaway, Vince Carter, Sharif Abdul-Rahim. You know, it was an incredible, and the dunk Vince had on Frederick Rice, that dunk.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like, did that just happen? Like, did we really see that in person? But yeah, I mean, Lithuania gave us a run in the game before the gold medal game. We beat France in the gold medal game, and Sydney was a long trip. Yeah. Sydney, Australia was a long trip, but it was incredible.
Yeah.
I mean, for us, when we go over and play, we kind of blend in. I think you can kind of tell, okay, those are the hockey guys, just the way we walk and how we build. But for you guys, show up in the Olympic Village, I mean, were people going nuts? Like, okay, here are these
It was interesting. Like, we actually went to more of the events, the track and field, beach volleyball, and, you know, and tennis. And, you know, like, it was just so much fun, man. Yeah. You know, a lot of fun. And getting to, like, really get to know the other athletes like that, right? You know, and walk in Olympic Stadium. And you're like, man, that's Lindsay Davenport and the Serena Williams and Venus. And, like, you're walking in the Olympic Stadium, you know, with them. And that was truly special.
And I remember just being in the village, that energy between athletes, too. Yeah. And you know, for us, we have the same type of schedule, 82 games plus playoffs. We play every other day.
Mm-hmm.
But for a lot of these athletes, they plan 4 years
for that.
And this is it. Like, it's a big moment for us as well. But for them, so just to see the intensity, but also the energy in the village, that's probably my favorite part almost, other than playing the actual game, just to wander around in the village, sit at the food court, and you see all these athletes preparing for the biggest moments in their life.
In their life. This could be like, you know, you never knew you'd get back to this.
No.
You know, and that's the thing that you saw. You were like so intensely, like passionately cheering for them.
Yeah, talk about preparation. Like so many sports other than hockey and hoops, like that's the end of the road. Maybe there's track, you know, where you can make some money.
Yeah.
But many of these are just, you know, not going to get paid a lot throwing a javelin, you know. So it is like their holy grail. So that leads me to my next question. I got two Olympic gold medalists with me. Would you trade it for an NBA championship or a Stanley Cup?
I don't think so. I think, you know, when you put all the years into something and you go through it with someone, like I always think that when people are like crying when they win a trophy, those aren't really tears of the tears of joy, but they're just like, man, what you've gone through.
It's relief.
It's like what you sacrificed for. And I think when you go through that grueling, I mean, to win a championship in the NBA, I mean, like we got close in 99 and you just think about like, that was a lockout season. So we played like 55 games. I mean, in a short season, we had three or four games where we played three games in a row, back to back to back.
Mm.
And you just think about how grueling a season is. And I think what you have to go through to get to that point.
Yeah. Yeah. Hank?
It's hard. I think it's two different things.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, of course, I would have loved to win the cup. No question about it. But there's so much pride in playing for your country.
Mm-hmm.
And if I go back to Sweden and I ask 10 Swedes on the street, I mean, obviously the Olympic gold, I think it's more important to people back home because it's closer to them and you play for your country. So I love that aspect of it. I would never want to trade the Olympic gold for it. But to your point, Alan, like just how much you go through to try to get a championship.
Yeah.
That's a lot. It's a lot. And I love that process of getting to closer to your teammates and the ups and downs. Yeah. Olympics is 2 weeks.
Yeah.
It's a great experience, but it's short.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love the building, the ups and downs, the grind, and because that's life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's living. Like that's what we did for every day, you know, for 9 months.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you talked earlier about loving the process.
Mm-hmm.
You gotta love that grind.
Mm-hmm.
Totally.
Yeah.
But yeah, so that was a long answer.
No,
Jay,
that's a good answer.
I hopefully understand.
They're different things. I think that's the right way to hold it.
But Alan, reflecting on your career, what are you most proud of when you think back? Is there a moment, or actually, if I ask you this, what comes to mind when you think about your career? Is there a moment or a teammate or?
I think one moment that really sticks out probably is the 24 to 48 hours of winning the Eastern Conference Championship and my daughter was born the next day. Mm. You know, like, that was so much at the pinnacle of, you know, your life, right? You're 28 years old and everything you work for. Now you've just clinched in New York to play in the NBA Finals, and the next day, you know, your first child is born. And I remember not being able to sleep, obviously, after that. And then I went into the bathroom, and, man, I couldn't take it. Like, I just started bawling. And I knew where it was coming from, but I didn't know what to do, you know what I mean? And it was just so much, you know, to take. All right, then I'm like, all right, good, I'm good.
Get it out.
Yeah. And then I'm good. And then you got back on the road and went to San Antonio, you know? And I never forget my wife in the hospital. And, you know, so many men go through it, but you go through this stage, you know, when you're an athlete, your child's born, and then you got to go to work and do your job. And you're like, wow, you know? So it was a lot. That probably was that moment or series of moments was probably what kind of, when I look back at my career, and obviously you're playing an NBA Finals, the pinnacle, to be most proud of, I probably, you know, we had one of our assistant coaches, you know, we were having this conversation about like managing, like durability. And he said, Alan, you realize that you only missed 19 games in 10 seasons, right? And I was like, wow, that I felt, you know, there was something close to that. But, like, that really is something that I can say. I don't like to use the word proud a lot, but it's like I can say that because I was blessed to stay healthy, but you also have to have a certain mentality that I'm going to prepare myself to endure a lot of those moments where, and this is when we were practicing. Like, we were practicing, you know, 2 hours, you know, and you're playing 82 games and you got playoffs. And if you're fortunate enough to go deep in the playoffs, you go further. And then if you make the All-Star game, you don't have that time. Mm-hmm. So I feel like that was something that I feel, you know, pretty good about just being available.
Showing up, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's something we talked about on the show earlier that if you only play when you feel great or close to great, you're going to play maybe 20 games.
That's right.
The rest of the time, you just got to find a way
to
get as close as you can to feeling great.
Yeah.
Sometimes you have to fake it to yourself.
A lot of times.
Like, hey, I feel great. I'm not tired. I feel so good. I'm strong. Yeah. Like, I'm fast.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But reality is like, wow, I'm hurting right now. But again, you can't leave room for questioning yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And that's part of the grind too.
Yeah, part of the whole process.
Like, what do you think about kind of like minutes and balancing and everything in today's game?
We have a lot more information. The guys have a lot more information to choose from.
Sure.
Right? They have, if you do this, then this will happen. And you have a lot of data. So, of course, they're going to use it. We didn't have all that information and data. So you injured, you hurt, all right, let's go. And you didn't really think that way. And plus, so I think it's hard to compare eras, to compare the load management thing. You know, you just have a lot more data. We didn't try, even when people talk about like how you compare, what would you do in this era? Like, I don't go there too much just because I would have probably trained when I was in high school differently. You know what I mean? I would have played differently in college. I may not even have played 4 years in college. So to say how you would have played in today's game, you got to go back to how you would have prepared to play in today's game from a younger age. Mm-hmm. And like my son, who's 11 years old, he's already, I don't like him out shooting NBA threes, but he can. I'm like, when I was 10 years old, I don't even know if I could shoot an NBA three.
Right.
You know, these you just... It's a different time and you have a different viewpoint. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I mean, I just think it's hard because you don't have the we didn't have the information.
Sure.
And the vision and the level of expectation that they do now.
Yeah. I mean, I think the hot take culture today, which is like, each one, like a soundbite, like who's the best, who's the GOAT? It's impossible.
I don't even go there.
Yeah. You can't really, because the whole system, as you said, would change.
Yeah. I think Michael said it the one time, like he doesn't like to even say, he really thinks and knows he's the best, but but he doesn't talk about it that way because of what we said. Like, you know, he understands what Larry Bird went through, what Isaiah Thomas, what they went through, and it's different.
Yeah,
you know,
same thing in hockey today, right?
I mean, the game is so different.
Yeah,
we can maybe talk about who was the best at the time.
Sure.
Yeah,
but to talk about players that play, you know, it's 20, 30 years in between. That's almost impossible. It doesn't matter what sport it is.
Yeah.
To your point, Alan, like the technology, information, how they train. And it's just a different game. Hockey, look at that game. Like the difference of that game from 80s, early 90s, mid 90s to now, the speed and how well trained they are coming up into the game.
Because it's true.
What they eat, what they know.
You can't change one thing without everything else changing, right? That's the whole system. You look at... You know, I think it'll be interesting in 3 years to look at what happens in college sports with nil and how that changes the system. I don't think we've seen like all of the...
Well, that's the thing that it remains, that desire to get the bag.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? That's not going to go anywhere, right? It's just the bag is bigger.
So we touched on it earlier. You play for your dad, but you talked a lot about... you know, your relationship to your dad and the influence he had on you as a player, as a person. And, you know, when you play for him, I'm always curious to hear when guys play for their dads. Like, how's that relationship?
Yeah.
Do you feel extra pressure or could you block that?
We had a unique situation, I think, too, because, like, it's different. A lot of times... It depends on the makeup of the team, like your role on the team. I think for me, I came in as one of the top players, high school players. So when I got there, you know, we had seniors. The first thing I had to do is I had to disprove that I was able to work. That was my first job. And he didn't have to tell me that. I had to come in because I didn't want people to say whatever they were going to say. I knew I had enough talent, but I knew I had a long way to go to endure college, to understand what this level was going to be like. So for me, it was about getting stronger and just working. My dad, one thing he always would tell me is like, if you're in a competitive environment and someone's working harder than you, whether it's a practice, a tryout, a game, if someone's working harder than you and you notice that, then that's a problem. So for me, I just did that first. And then just be humble. You know, don't think too highly of yourself. And at that point, I figured then people knew that I was going to work hard and my motive was going to be good. And then it's about producing. And after that, I'm like, okay, the pressure that I felt like I had to do it, perform well just for our family. I mean, you know, he grew up 15 minutes from our campus. And growing up, he and my grandfather probably couldn't even get into games because of the color barrier, right? Mm-hmm. So it was always like a bigger picture, but I think our relationship worked because I was one of the guys that the team kind of depended on. So I knew that I had a big role. So now it was a matter of, you're going to perform, but how are you going to do it? What type of character and you're going to do it? And, you know, there were a lot of times when, you know, I knew my teammates probably didn't want to say certain things that they probably wanted to say around me. But then there were times when they did. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like we were pretty tight under the circumstances. And, you know, my father got me I can say this now, but he got me a Jeep Cherokee. He's like, no, this isn't just for you, right? It's for everybody, right? And, you know, things like that, I think we became a family. You know, still to this day, you know, I'm cool with, you know, a lot of my teammates. you know, I had a lot of family support from the community because he grew up. Mm-hmm. So I think a lot of the support that we got wasn't just he and my, you know, me and my mother. It was like we had a whole community that was there because he grew up there that really wanted to make it work.
Yeah. Speaking of relationship, father, son, something you focus on through your foundation.
Yeah.
Healthy and productive relationships between fathers and sons.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, can you talk a little bit about the work you guys do and a little bit about your own experience? It sounds like, obviously, he was a great teacher.
Yeah.
And the importance of having one.
Yeah, I think when you every level you get to, you kind of appreciate the people who are around you, who helped push you, who kind of held you accountable, but supported you at the same time. And I just, when every coach I had, I just had a, I won't say a soft spot, but I had an understanding. You know, sometimes I didn't take things personal because I knew kind of like behind that, there were a lot that they were going through. So I think that helped me. And then when you look at leaders in general, you know, you look at things that they have to go through. So we started doing a lot of workshops and mentoring and retreats just to try to help a young person develop a healthy relationship with an adult. Because, you know, all the statistics, social, emotional well-being, character development, things that are affecting our young people today more dramatically than ever, social media, you know, mental health. So much of that is kind of like, how can a father and a mentor and a coach really support that young person and help them along the way? So we felt like there needed to be kind of a lens and a language, right? Like the same way, you know, your coach or, you know, Phil Jackson had the triangle offense and, you know, John Wooden had the high, you have to have a system, right, that works. And we felt like a father and a mentor and a coach needs a system of life to kind of help young people, to give them that language. So, and we developed this. This is our brand now. We have a merchandise. We have apparel. We do multimedia, helping young people. Our products, you know, we are sold in the Garden now. We do, we have all 30 NBA teams. We have about 50 college licenses. So our whole thing is these five fundamentals: faith, integrity, sacrifice, leadership, and legacy. We believe those are the basic five fundamentals of life. And we just want to help adults transfer those values into the young people so that they can be healthy, they can be productive, no matter what they do, right? They have a foundation. Because a lot of young people are like, what do I need? What am I doing? Mm-hmm. Like, what am I supposed to be doing? What's my purpose? What's my identity? And so let's start with, you know, these basics, you know, like in hockey and basketball, you start with your fundamentals and you grow from there. And so it has become something that became like helping a father talk to their young people or have the relationship to, you know, doing a lot more. So it's been fun.
That's great. How much time are you spending on the foundation?
Well, the foundation we have our programming and then with the brand. So it's kind of like we do both. Like with the brand, we kind of do events. We host. We have a partnership with Fanatics. We have, with name, image, and likeness, as you're saying, we're doing a lot of social impact work with college student athletes. So it's kind of like grown from just doing a curriculum to like actually doing the content, doing the events, and doing like the programming. But it's all based on this basic idea of have a same thing we're doing now.
Right.
Like we're having a conversation on our father. We're talking to have a conversation on winning, but they all come together because, you know, the king, right? He's here because of the life that, not just because of what you did on the ice, right? It's just who you were and who you are. And I think that's the idea, right? How can we continue to have those dialogues? So to me, I don't split it up in how much time. It's all the time. It's everything, right? It's like I have the same conversation with my daughter on the way to school as I might have with, you know, Jericho Sims, you know, just about like, what do you want to do, right? And we just have these dialogues all the time. And the more young people can kind of internalize values, better off they're going to be.
I love it.
Yeah, it's great. I think it's so important. You're talking about time. I mean, you have 7 kids, 5 daughters, 2 sons. Yeah. First off, you must be extremely busy.
Yeah.
But as a father, Is there one thing that you feel like this is the most important thing? We have a rookie dad here.
I'm soaking it in here.
Yeah. No, but for you as a dad, like you have 7 kids, juggling with 2, but is there one thing that you feel like this is the most important thing?
I would say faith, man. I think our faith, like at the end of the day, I'm not always going to be here. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? And that's why, you know, you can have values, but if you don't have like that firm footing, and I'm like, I think that's what I held on to, what got me going is gotta believe, if God has something for you, then nothing can be against you, right? And I think, so if I had to hold on to that one thing that you give the kids, because they're gonna be off on their own, they're gonna be in this crazy world, and who are you going to subscribe to, right? Who's gonna influence who you are? And who's going to influence what you're going to do? And you're going to have something that's firm that you can hold on to that's not based on what social media is saying about you, what fans are saying about you. It's, you know, who are you really listening to? What are you telling yourself? And, you know, we got that from our parents, and I think that's the only thing we can – I mean, there's a whole lot of other stuff, right? But I think that's probably the one thing I would say.
Yeah.
Biggest challenge – being a parent.
I think knowing you're gonna mess up, knowing you're gonna say something, you know, they remember everything. Yeah. So you can't like be walking around on eggshells, like you can't, you know, thinking you're gonna do something that they're gonna remember. But I think it's for me, it's like it's the time, you know, like balancing all out. Trying to keep that healthy relationship with, you know, with my wife and their mom, because that's really important that they see
that model.
They see, like, they know you're going to mess up. You're going to say something you regret. They know that. But if I think they see the consistency of you trying to get it right, you know what I mean? Like, you're really trying that, like, that's a priority. I think that matters. That matters too. You know what I mean?
To me, what I find pretty hard right now is my kids are 11 and 9. I want to give them everything and nothing at the same time.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I mean, I love to see them happy. I want to give them opportunity to succeed, but at the same time, I want them to earn it. I want them to understand it takes dedication and time to do anything great.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how do you balance that? Like I think that's a constant daily.
Totally.
I want to give them love and support. I want to give them as much as I can because it makes me so happy to see them happy.
Yeah.
But at the same time, like, no, you got to earn it.
Mm-hmm. And it's hard because their perspective is so different.
Yeah.
Not just because we're adults and they're not, because of what the world is telling them. Like the world is telling them, like, it's going, you know, you got to go get this money. You got to get these followers. The world is telling them the things that are so superficial. And even though, like, we dealt with that, it's just on a different level. So the way they think and speak, right, is you got to just neutralize it, but love them at the same time.
Yeah, you know? I think every generation must go through this. And I know there's some seismic changes.
Yeah.
Probably, you guys are good examples of that, where you achieved – you know, superstardom in sports. And that changes the family trajectory from a stability, finance, risk profile forever. But like, I think going back to your point, like if you have the foundation and you have values, then you can kind of distill the rest of it to being noise. Like work ethic doesn't substitute, there's no handouts.
Yeah.
But here's your starting point and you're privileged to be starting here. But to get to here, you know, to make the next change in our family tree, like, you're going to have to work just as hard as I did. You're going to have to, you know, sacrifice just as much as I did. It's just going to be in a different arena.
Right.
Yeah.
And I think that's a hard lesson for us as parents to conceptualize.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I'm, again, it's a constant battle. Yeah.
It's a constant battle.
But so your oldest, was it he or she? She was four when you retired. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So have your kids watched any tape of you when you played? What's their opinion of you as a player? Do they agree with everyone else? You were a smooth jump shooter.
They didn't really get to see me in person. That's one of the things I wish, you know. I just couldn't play anymore when they were at that age. But I think they're aware You know, when we're out, you know, people, you know, they hear it and, and they see the clips. I think my youngest son is the one who's probably more interested and intrigued and curious than anyone, which is interesting for me because he's the last one. And I'm he's 11.
Okay.
And he's curious. Like my oldest is, she graduated from NYU and it was great, you know, having her here. And then my son, is just finishing, he's in grad school. And then you have four girls and they do everything. You got soccer, volleyball, golf. Amazing. And what's the other one? Soccer, you got volleyball, you got golf, and high jump.
Oh, wow.
So my youngest is the one who really is curious, right? He got a screensaver, you know, of me playing, and I'm like, man, that's, you know, it touched me.
Yeah.
And but he's the one that kind of like pays attention, and he's like, you know, ask questions about when I played, and you know, so I'm watching to see, you know, where it goes. But you know, it's kind of fun when, you know, people remind them. But at the end of the day, I think the most important thing is they have to see like the bigger picture of it all. You know what I mean?
Do you talk a lot of basketball at home? Or is it more when the random questions
They're huge Knicks fans now just because they've been around it. So when I'm in a game, you know, they're just in it. When I'm like on the road traveling with the team, I know like my oldest, she doesn't miss. She doesn't miss a game, you know. And now they pay attention. And then my sophomore, she's a huge. So they love it. They love the Knicks. They love watching. And you know, it's fun because, you know, it's like it's authentic to them.
Yeah. It's like you're the community leader
in a
very different one way than your dad was.
So your role today, VP of Player Leadership and Development with the Knicks. How your transition from playing to the front office, is this where we're going to see you in the next 5 years, or are we going to see you as a coach with the history and the family, or is that something that interests you?
I think the reason I probably didn't go into coaching from day one is because I saw the commitment my father made, you know, and in playing 12 years in the NBA, I kind of almost turned that off in a way. I think deep down I probably would have, you know, because I'm a coach, his son, you know, my grandfather. But I also realized, like, I wanted to have quality time with family. And fortunately, you know, from Jim Dolan to all the general managers who I've worked under, right, they've been very, very, like, helpful with me and kind of walking me through, like, this is where, you know, you can be helpful with the team. I ran our G League team for 6 seasons. I've scouted. I've been involved in different levels. And I think for me, so when I think about the next wave of what's happening, I think between high school, college, and NBA players coming in, understanding like what your brand really is. So when I look at leadership and I look at development, we look at development as like, who is this whole person? You're right. And I don't use the word on or off the court. I kind of use this term above the court, because your perspective on how you see everything should sit above it all, right? It shouldn't be like, I do this when I'm on the court and I do this when I'm off the court. It should be up here when you do everything. And what's, I think when athletes are coming up, they're just looking at their value. Like, we're all saying, we're trying to increase your value, right? We're trying to help you level up in life. But there takes a certain kind of way to live and way to think to do that. And those are the conversations that really kind of drive and motivate me now. You know what I mean? And especially after being in this world of the nonprofit, the for-profit, it all comes back to your brand and who you really, really are and how we can elevate that.
And I think that's so helpful and so important for players that come into a big stage, especially New York City, to have that resource and then someone that value it so much and have the insight. Yeah. So I think it's awesome the fact that you spend so much time on it. And yeah, I'm with you on coaching. That's a time commitment. Yeah. And you kind of back to the playing days, right? Yeah. The everyday grind. And I had the love and passion for to play the game. I don't think I have enough to be a coach and put that time in.
Yeah.
But you know, it's like the good thing about coaching is it's real time. It's a truth teller, right? Like you sit and watch something with a player, you see it right there. You can tell me whatever you want. That film, like they say, the film doesn't lie. And now we can talk about why you did it or why you didn't do it, but there it is. And I think the thing about coaching is you can see and correct and develop in real time, right? Especially when you have a process. So that part, you know, I still kind of like enjoy watching that and kind of talking to the coaches and understanding like the perspective of a player, because I can probably identify with some, but you're right. Like it's a lot of time, and you know it's rewarding, but there's a big sacrifice.
Yeah.
Well, I can say you would be an amazing coach with all the knowledge and how to approach people. All the years I've been running into you, I think, you're such a class act, nice guy, and I really
appreciate
it.
Same to you, man. I appreciate
to know
it.
You over the years, and we're so grateful that you took time to
honored.
Jump on the show here.
Yeah. It's my honor, man.
That's awesome.
Like I said, it's long overdue. I'm glad to see you doing this, man.
Thank you, Alan.
Yeah.
All right. The Knicks are playing soon, so we're going to head over to the Garden.
That's right.
But thanks again.
Yeah.
Really appreciate
it. Real pleasure, man.
I'll see you on 33rd Street in a couple hours.
That's right. That's right.
A big thank you to Knicks legend Alan Houston for joining us today here at Club 30. You know, a lot of good advice there on fatherhood. This guy knows what he's talking about.
Yeah, he has some reps.
Well, grandfather and his dad, great coaches. And he talked about this. Being a great coach is also about being a great mentor.
Yeah, and a great parent.
Great parent. It's about, you know, guiding people and thinking back to when I was a kid, the great coaches, there were more than just a coach, more than just a hockey coach or a sports coach.
Yeah.
It was someone you looked up to and listened to. And I find it's so important to have those types of people in your life, especially early on.
Yeah. Yeah. The one word I took away from that talk with Alan was character.
Yeah.
You can just, some people you meet, they just have character, like the right kind of character, and it's like a full person thing, and it's impressive because, you know, I don't know, he just has this quiet confidence about him, you know. So I'm not surprised. So I obviously had never met him before, but just like, you know, kind of sitting here with him, you knew who he was exactly. Yep. It was really impressive.
Yeah, and his calmness. I mean, I got to know him over the years and the conversations we had at the Garden, at the practice facility, and just he talked a lot about knowing where, you know, keep your both feet on the ground and that stability.
Yeah.
You could feel that just talking to him. And I really hope all you listeners at home or wherever you're listening from, in the car maybe, that you felt that. And I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, me too. If we had more time, I would have loved to hear more about that practice squad original dream team experience.
Yeah, we had a lot of questions we didn't have time to ask about all the pranks he used to run in the locker room. But we'll save it for next time.
Yeah, sign of a great conversation. So thanks to Alan. Thanks everybody at home for tuning in and listening. Please follow along.
Yeah, we'll see you next week.
See you next week.